UK Wine Show, show number 159, Recycling with Paul McLevin. G'day, my name's Chris Scott, and welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 159, for the 5th of June 2009. For those in the UK, I hope you've been enjoying the fantastic weather. It's almost as if summer's arrived. In this week's show, I have a great interview with Paul McLevin from OI. You may recall we chatted with Paul about a month ago about wine bottles and how they're made. Well, this week we continue our theme we started last week when we spoke to Gemma Scott about collecting glass and glass recycling. And we talked to Paul about what can be done to glass in terms of recycling and why the method of collection is so important. But before we get into the interview with Paul, we have loads to talk about. The spotlight this week is a book review, David Bird's Understanding Wine Technology. A great book on the overview of winemaking and the science of winemaking. And don't forget, you're going to have to work out our mystery grape, which this week is a low-yielding, late-ripening red grape, which produces deep colour, full-bodied wines. It's characterised by dark fruits and cherries, herbal notes, and sometimes even a gamey edge, and has the potential to make very fine wines. Any ideas? Well, I'll give you more clues just before the interview, but next up we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. A study by the University of East Anglia has found that a glass of wine a day, or a pint of beer, can protect against gallstones. Drinking 2 units of alcohol a day reduces the risk of developing the painful stones by a third. It's been known for some time that moderate drinking can reduce the chances of gallstone formation, but this is the first study to show how much alcohol was required. The study examined the dietary habits of over 25,000 people over a 10-year period, during which time 267 patients developed gallstones. Results showed that those who consumed 2 units of alcohol per day had a 1/3 reduction in their risk of developing gallstones. And 2 units is equal to a medium-sized glass of wine, a pint of beer, or a double shot of whiskey.
Good news, the evidence continues to mount up on the health benefits of moderate consumption of wine. Well, not in this study, it's red wines in general that are best for you overall. What's next up, Jane?
Well, the most powerful person in the world of wine, according to the Decanter Power List for 2009, is Richard Sands, chairman of Constellation Brands, which is best known in the UK for Hardy's and Bamrock Station. Sands was last at the top in 2005, but dropped to third place in 2007, when US wine critic Robert Parker beat him to number one slot. Parker drops one place to number two in 2009, a sign, according to his entry, that his popularity is waning ever so slightly. Decanter magazine suggests the reasons for this are twofold. Firstly, outside the US, there's less and less interest in big, ripe, high-alcohol wines that Parker favours. And within the United States, he's facing increased competition and sharp criticism more recently over the ethics of two of his contributors, as reported in the Wall Street Journal. The Decanter Top 10 includes 3 new entries, teetotal French Premier Nicolas Sarkozy, Jean-Christophe Deslaz of screwcap manufacturers Alcan, and Pernod Ricard's chief Pierre Pringuet.
I know these lists can be a bit silly after all, group of reporters making up the list, but Decanter did allude to some interesting problems with Parker's people. According to the Wall Street Journal, several journalists have been on trips and charging Wine Australia, the Australian generic body in charge of promoting wine, $25,000 for the privilege. While Parker's people are being witch hunted for this, it's not uncommon for trade bodies to pay for journalists' flights. If you want to read a reasoned and well thought out, if somewhat self-flagellating view on this, try Malcolm Gluck's The Great Wine Swindle, where he spends quite a bit of time and angst on this very topic, but it makes for some well thought out points of view. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, Bloomsbury Auctions, best known as a specialist in rare books and fine art, will hold its first ever wine auction in New York on the 19th of June. Bloomsbury will bring their auction house expertise to the world of wine in a collaboration with fine wine merchant Sokolin. To attract clients, the buyer's premium at 17% is lower than other major wine auctioneers, and Bloomsbury is offering a money-back guarantee on wine that's damaged or doesn't match the photos on its website. Along with many Bordeaux first growths, the 778-lot sale includes 200 bottles of Domaine de la Romanée Conti and a six-pack of 1985 Sassicaia. That's it from me this week, but as always, don't forget to visit our website 3050.co.uk for these stories in full.
Cheers, Jane. I realised reading the news, I didn't know too much about auction houses and wine auctions. The thing that caught my eye was the buyer's premium of 17%. The buyer's premium is a percentage additional charge on the hammer price of the lot. It's made by the auctioneer to cover their administrative expenses. Sounds like quite a big bit of administration they run. I think I'm going to have to do a couple of shows on wine auctions later on in the year, so stay tuned for that. But next up, we have the spotlight. This week, we review David Bird's book, Understanding Wine Technology. I ran into David Bird a couple of months ago, and it reminded me of his book, Understanding Wine Technology. It was a book I'd read several years ago as part of my recommended reading from the Diploma of Wine I sat with WSCT. Rereading it this week has reminded me of what an excellent book it is. First published in 2000, it's no spring chicken, but has aged well with virtually no content out of date. The meat of Understanding Wine Technology is looking at the methods of taking grapes and producing wine. Through it, it looks at presses, must adjustment, fermentation, filtering, fining, bottling, and all the equipment used to achieve this. While David is a chemist and a master of wine, he's managed to show chemical reactions and even chemical equations in a fairly straightforward way, which is readable. Or, if it's not your cup of tea, easy to skip. Now, even though I've read this book before and I consider myself fairly knowledgeable, rereading this has corrected some of my thinking, which was wrong, particularly regarding the stability of sweet wines and what stops fermentation. I found it enjoyable to read, and at 226 pages, it's a fairly quick read as well. Now that I've reacquainted myself with the book, I see myself referring to it more often. It's an excellent introduction through the medium weight book on winemaking and the technology behind it, and the options that winemakers have. I consider this an excellent book and essential reading for any serious wine student. It can be a bit dry for those who simply enjoy drinking wines. If you want to get a deep understanding of the ideas behind winemaking, it's a must read. In the end, I rated this book 90 out of 100. Well, that ends the book review. I did promise you more clues for the mystery grape before the interview. So our mystery grape's home now is Chile, where more than 4,000 hectares is planted, chiefly in the Central Valley. But its roots are in the Medoc, which is surprising since there's so little of it in France now. It was cultivated there in the early 18th century and with Cabernet Franc made up the reputation of the region's best chateaus. It was also important in Graves, but abandoned in Bordeaux because of the susceptibility to colure. That's poor fruit set and it results in low yields. However, it was transported from there to Southern America before Phloxera, though it wasn't until 1994 that a lot of the vines thought to be Merlot in Chile were identified as our mystery grape. Any ideas? I'll give you the answers to this after this week's interview with Paul McLavin from OI. We talked to Paul about the issues associated with recycling glass from the people who run the factories that do the recycling. Hi, I'm here with Paul McLavin for Owens, Illinois, or OI. You're a glass manufacturer, aren't you?
Yes, we are.
Excellent. We're going to be talking a wee bit about recycling glass today and some of the do's and don'ts, etc., of glass. But first of all, what is glass and can you actually recycle it?
Yes, very much so. Glass is basically originally sand that has been fused together with some other materials. Glass is infinitely recyclable. So by that, what I mean is you can take a bottle, you break it up, you melt it in the furnace, you make another bottle. That bottle can go get filled, used, comes back into the waste stream, refilled, etc. So it's an infinite process. It doesn't degrade each time you break it down and remelt it.
You've still got to melt the thing down in the first place. So is it just, do you use the same amount of energy when you're melting glass down as opposed to making glass in the first instance?
Using recycled glass gives us a couple of advantages. One, as a rough figure, for every 10% of recycled material you use 3% less energy. So it is a significant reduction in energy required to melt existing glass rather than fuse sand into glass. Mm-hmm. The other good thing is that to make 1 ton of glass, we actually need 1.2 tons of sand and other materials. So every ton of glass ton of recycled glass we can use means it's 1.2 tons of virgin raw materials we don't have to quarry.
Oh, okay.
So it's a real bonus for us.
Excellent. And you guys use quite a bit of recycled glass in your bottles. How much can you get away with pure virgin sands versus recycled glass?
Depends on the colour, the quality and the availability. In our green furnace at the moment, we're using probably over 80% recycled material, mainly consumer waste. We can probably use up to 90% with the furnaces we have. With amber glass or brown glass and clear glass, the percentage is quite a lot lower. It's probably about 30%. But there, a lot of the issues are around availability of good quality glass coming back to us from the waste stream, and also the colour standards that we work to. People do like a very clear glass for their products. And with the material get back, the more recycled material we use, then it tends to develop a slight green tint because of impurities in the recycled material.
What, you mean a bit of green glass?
Sorry. Bit of green glass put in the wrong tank or not taken out.
So we were talking earlier that green glass is quite a good type of glass. Is good for recycling because it seems to be the catch-all. You know, everything can go into green glass. I would have thought brown glass you could put almost anything in as well. Why is brown glass so fussy?
The reaction that forms brown glass is probably a bit more sensitive to other materials being in there. Naturally speaking, or naturally thinking, when you think of mixing colours, you can imagine them all merging into a brown colour.
Yeah, brown seems to be the general colour. Everything
or beige, maybe. But with glass, the green colour is very dominant and it can really cover over other colours. So if the colours of glass are mixed, then we can put that into the green furnace. But with the reaction and the colour standards for amber, that won't accept the mixed colour.
Okay. So what are these impurities that you can get in glass? Because when I put my glass out, I don't take the labels off. Well, I used to take the labels off. If they're really nice bottles of wine, I might take the label off. But generally, I just chuck them into the glasses. You know, there's bits of metal from the screw cap sometimes. There's the paper from the label, etc. Is that a problem to you guys at all?
Most of it isn't an issue in that when we process the recycled material when it comes back, we'll sort it, we'll put it through magnets, we'll blow off any plastics or other materials that may have got in.
Blow off as in?
As in use blowers, just...
You know. Oh, okay.
So the lightest thing on the conveyor will just get... Blown away because the glass is much denser, so it'll
stay on there. Yeah,
things like paper, any paper that is left on the glass will just burn up in the furnace, so that won't really be an issue.
Do you get carbon?
Not significant amounts. We tend, when we crush up the glass, a lot of the paper will be stripped away. Any bits that do get through really aren't an issue for us. Metal getting into the furnace is a slightly bigger issue, but when we crush the glass, a lot of the metal is taken away by magnets, etc.
But aluminium, though, you must get a...
Aluminium, lead can be an issue if that gets through. So ideally...
I suppose once you've crushed it, though, it's easy to separate out the aluminium. Because I'm thinking of the rings on an aluminium bottle. If you've got a screw cap, you get the screw cap, which you obviously biff into the bin, which maybe we should recycle that, but we won't talk about that. But then you've got this aluminium ring on the bottom of the bottle, and that goes into the bin as well. But I suppose once you've crushed it, that bit of aluminium probably is...
It tends to come away. I mean...
It's easier to separate.
Personally, I actually take it off and put it in the metal bin.
Oh. There's me being told that, to.
That's just me. One of our big issues are things like pottery or Pyrex ware. They don't melt down in the furnace, and yet they have a similar density and look to glass material. So, you know, any consumers out there, if they can avoid putting those sorts of things in their recycled trays or in the bottle banks, then that would help us.
Okay, what about plastic bags? I saw a few plastic bags floating around, but I suppose they come away.
They tend to get blown away or picked away by the sorters. But generally, I think from our point of view, the more glass that can be collected, separated from other materials, the better.
That raises an interesting thing, isn't it? Separate glass. We were talking to Gemma last week, and she was saying that glass has a higher financial value to them. It's worth more. You obviously pay more for it than a mixed glass. But there's quite a lot of effort to separate glass out. From your point of view, is separates really that much better than mixed glass?
Oh, yeah. Well, as I said, 80-90% recycled material in the green. If you collect mixed glass, pure mixed glass can only go into the green furnace. So we're already using virtually the maximum we can. If it's colour separated, then you need large chunks of glass to be able to recognise and separate it. The technology is such that it needs to be a reasonably large piece. So you can only get a percentage of the glass separated out. A lot of the technology also can only spot the difference between clear glass and coloured glass. So you're still losing out on your amber, which is still mixed in. So really, if you can keep it separated from the beginning of the collection process, that gives us the best opportunity to use all that colour in the right colour and really get the best environmental and economical advantages out of it.
We talked a wee while ago about bottle weights and the manufacturing process of glass in a previous show. What are the issues associated with bottle weights? Is it a case that the thinner that you make the glass, the better it is and more economical it is for you guys?
We tend to quite often refer to an idea of a right weight, which is this concept that for a certain design, there will be an optimum weight for that container. For marketing reasons, it may be that you want to make it heavier or lighter. Also, for traditional reasons, you know, bottles probably were heavier in the past than they are today. So for a number of reasons, you may want to make the bottle a different weight to the natural weight you'd want to make it. There is also differences between process in that with the narrow neck press and blow process we talked about, where you control the distribution of the glass that much better, you can actually go lighter more consistently. Mm-hmm. Now, to ensure the strength of the containers are fit for purpose, we have minimum thickness limits and impact resistance limits. So whenever we're designing a container and looking at the thickness of the glass, we have to ensure that it conforms to certain limits. Yeah. So that it'll give a container that is suitable for the filler and the consumer. So really, when we're designing a container, there's a correct weight, and then there's potentially a desired weight by the consumer or the customer.
What are the trade-offs? Is it because obviously the less glass you use, the less raw materials, so the bottle, at least the raw materials, will be cheaper. Is there a cost associated with going too light?
Certainly, if it starts interfering with the speed and efficiencies of the, then you may actually get a smaller output for, say, a day's production. So although you've gone lighter, perhaps you're making more rejects or you're on the limits of the strength measurements. So, yeah, there will be an optimum weight for it. Technology has got better, control systems have got better, and that optimum weight has probably been reduced. But there will still be an optimum weight for that container.
What do you think the sweet spot is for a glass weight bottle from a manufacturer's point of view?
Depends very much on the design and the height of the bottle, whether it is embossed. You know, we see bottles with a lot of branding on it.
Not wine bottles, though.
Not many wine bottles, but Chateau Neuf de Pape, for instance, has a large emblem up on the shoulder.
Same with German bottles.
Yeah.
Yeah, some of the German wines.
If you think about the old Black Tower bottle, that had a sort of hammered effect and a very, you know, often a taller bottle. If a tall, thin bottle may be heavier than a shorter, fatter bottle because of the distance you're trying to get the glass down, etc. So it really depends on a number of factors. Currently, we're making a lot of wine bottles anywhere from, 340 up to 700-800 grams for a standard wine bottle.
But 340 is quite a viable bottle. It's not too hard to make.
It's certainly within the narrow neck press and blow process, we seem to be achieving it.
When we're talking about 340, we mean 340 grams.
Sorry, yes.
The weight of the bottle, yeah. Okay, what about going, say, down to 300? Is it possible to get down to 300?
There are bottles out there at 300, certainly.
Wine bottles?
Wine bottles, yeah. 750ml wine bottles. It requires a lot of control. It's not the easiest weight. And, it's pushing the boundaries at the moment. As control techniques improves, it might might become easier. Mm-hmm. But certainly, you know, our colleagues in France have been making them for a long time, so it's just really getting to know the process and the controls to be able to do it.
Do you guys make Bordeaux or Burgundy bottles here? You know, the Bordeaux, the long ones, the big shoulders, you know, they look like something out of the 80s, you know, Dallas sort of environment.
Yeah.
And the Burgundy looks more like a student. Sort of slooping around.
A bit slouched. In the UK, most of the demand tends to be for Bordeaux bottles.
Yep.
So we're producing primarily Bordeaux here.
Are you producing for the UK wine market, you know, producers in the UK, or is it more for bulk importing and filling?
Most of our demand is for bulk imported wine that's being filled in the UK.
Mm-hmm. And where are the bottles being consumed? Because we're in north of London, just north of the M25 in London Harrow here, but I know wines are imported into Manchester, Liverpool area, and so that's a fair old way to truck the bottle as well.
Yeah, a lot of our bottles go down into the Bristol Avonmouth area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we also send some bottles up to the Manchester area or even the Midlands. There's a couple of bottling facilities there, so we're relatively well situated with regards to motorways, etc., to get to a range of locations quite easily.
I suppose the key thing is that you're north of London, so you've got a lot of waste glass being produced in London. So your raw material, strangely enough, is actually quite local.
Yeah, we are about the only glass manufacturer in the southeast, so we do tend to be the first stop for a lot of the material coming out of the London area. So, yeah, our recycling rates are probably above the industry average.
One of the other uses for glass is to go into road aggregate, but you're not so keen on that. What's the reason for that?
No, it tends to kill the benefits in one go. If you put the recycled glass back into remelt for glass containers, then that can continue going around that loop indefinitely.
Mm-hmm.
If you put it into aggregates or landfill or bury it in whichever way, then that's a one-stop shop. Once it's done, it's done. You don't really save any energy. You're stopping some other aggregates being used. But if you use it in glass container, you're saving energy, you're reducing aggregate use, and you're being able to do that again and again.
You mentioned a thing called a package recovery net, or PRN. What is that, and how does that work within recycling glass?
Each person in the supply chain has a responsibility to recover or recycle materials. Now, as a reprocessor of cullet, i.e. we melt it and put it back into glass containers, we generate these PRNs, or recycling notes. And these can then be sold to generate more infrastructure for recycling. The money must only be used for either education or infrastructure for recycling. We're reprocessing the glass and generating PRNs from that material. Unfortunately, if glass goes into aggregates, then PRNs are also generated. So whilst we're generating a better environmental use of that material, there's no differentiation in the current system between the two uses. So we'd much rather see a system where if a material is being used well and reused, then there is a benefit demonstrated in the system for that.
Okay, and I suppose also from a point of view is if the council know that they can mix their waste up and then grind it up and use it in road aggregate, they're not incentivized to encourage separation, which is what you really want to use it in your clear glass or brown glass.
Exactly. We've actually seen a reduction in the amount of glass going into packaging or going back into packaging. So every year, more glass is being collected at the curbside or at the bottle bank, but actually the amount that we're able to use in glass containers has reduced because it's not of good enough quality or it's mixed. So if we could actually keep it separated from an earlier process, we could use more recycled material. That would have a better benefit for the environment, and really everybody would gain.
Just listening to you, it sounds like the best thing to do is to make sure your clear glass is separated out, and I'm not sure about brown glass, maybe brown glass, but it doesn't really matter what's going in with your green glass. So if you do separate out your glass, make sure you separate out clear glass and possibly brown glass if you're that way inclined. Would that be a fair comment?
Well, I think it's fair to say that some councils do it very, very well. And they keep the materials separated. They either collect them separated or they separate them in the vehicle. Other councils will mix them all together and potentially even compact them together, which then makes it very difficult to get the materials we need. If in doubt, there's still the bottle banks, and they are a very good way of getting the glass separated and to us in a good format.
So you're actively encouraging people to use bottle banks if your council mixes?
I do, yes.
Do you get mixed waste collected from your curb?
I actually go to the bottle bank regularly.
You could just bring it into work and stick it on the pile.
There is actually a bottle bank just outside my office.
Excellent. All right then, Paul, I think we'll wrap it up there.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul, like myself, would rather use recycled glass rather than use it for roadfill. But it sounds as if we can't take any more mixed glass, as they're already using full capacity for the green glass that they're producing. Next week, we talk with RAP, the government-funded body tasked with improving our recycling. We find out from Nicola Jenkins what they're doing and what they think about different recycling strategies. But before we finish up, how are you getting on with our mystery grape? Well, hopefully the last clues gave it away. Well, it's an old red Bordeaux variety, now found in Chile, and mistakenly thought for Merlot, it is Carmenera. And to finish off with, we have our quote. It's apparently taken from the list of the Commander's Palace in New Orleans. Although, I'm not 100% sure, but it's a great quote. Here's to the corkscrew, a useful key to unlock the storehouse of wit, the treasury of laughter, the front door of fellowship, and the gate of pleasant folly. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.